Years ago, I served full-time as a parish minister. I served at a little church in central New York. Within a few months of starting that position, panic set in. I started to fear that I was going to run out of things to say on Sunday morning. I had a few good ideas, but after that, I wasn't sure. Well, a colleague suggested that I ought to start a sermon series. That is, a whole group of sermons on a related topic. Well, that relieved some of my anxiety. The next year, I had my first series. As I said, this is a little universalist church in a very small town in central New York, not typical at all. And while they said, "You can preach whatever you want," always good to hear, they did ask that, because it was part of their tradition, every Sunday we include the Lord's Prayer. So I thought, there's a good place to start. What I could do is preach a sermon every month on one line of the Lord's Prayer. Well, my first sermon, I couldn't get any further than "Our Father." Whoa, well, there's a whole sermon right there, isn't it? Well, for whatever reason, I thought one year I'd preach on the seven deadly sins. Well, I thought some of them could be fun. I don't know. But I quickly realized I could never remember what they all were, as you can tell by the title of this sermon. So I thought maybe I should try something else instead, and I abandoned the idea. But over the years, I continued to think that at least the idea of sin would be interesting to look at in a Unitarian Universalist context. Maybe it'd be worthwhile. After all, as a religious concept, sin has been around a long time. For centuries, Western culture was dominated by Christianity, and our understanding of what sin is really starts there. A common definition for sin is that it's a violation of God's law. Well, I already see problems here. What do we mean by God? What are those laws? Who gets to be the spokesperson to say what those laws are? Now, I understand a desire for order and clarity in life. Life can be a messy, very chaotic business. And I can appreciate the need some may have to find rules which plainly delineate what to do or not to do. In a way, I guess it would take some of the hard work out of life. These are the laws. Follow them, and all will be well. Don't, and everything goes to hell. Or you go to hell. Violating someone's view of God's law when those someones are powerful has sometimes in history had horrible consequences. Heretics, whenever they disagreed with the prevailing opinions of the powerful, have been executed for transgressing that divine law. There is the bloody record of the Inquisition in Europe, or on a smaller scale, and nonetheless deadly, the witch trials in Salem, not all that far from here. Certain people's idea of sin have shaped our own culture in a number of different ways and through various times. I mean, the legacy of prohibition was trying to avoid the sin of drink. Sunday blue laws, some of which are still around. It was to avoid the sins. Even some people's idea of sin had invaded the arts. Back in the days when all movies had to be approved by the Hays office, there was actually a rule which read as follows: no picture shall be produced that will lower the moral standards of those who see it. Hence, the sympathies of the audience should never be shown on the sides of crime, wrongdoing, evil, or sin. That sounds like a movie I'd like to see, actually. On a personal level, I really don't give much thought to the idea of sin, frankly. I accept life can be unpredictable. It can be complicated. It can be messy. I don't know that there are those simple rules out there. For a number of years, I taught classes in ethics. And believe me, if all I needed was a list of the laws or the rules we're supposed to follow, I would have been happy to hand those out on the first day of class instead of the syllabus and say, read them, go home, class dismissed. While sin is never the first thing on my mind, it has been among us, whether I care about it or not. There are some folks in this country who seem to take pride in publicly decrying the sins of others and are trying to make civil law conform to their own idea of divine law. And we've also had an opportunity to see how these folks react when one of their own political heroes is seen to commit what they would call sin. And sometimes it gets excused by saying, well, you know, we're all sinners and we all need forgiveness. Apparently, hypocrisy isn't a sin. Before the presidential election, there was a priest in San Diego who published a notice in the parish newsletter. That notice says that anyone who votes for a particular political party was committing a mortal sin and would be condemned to hell. Well, now, it just so happens that I voted with the party of the damned, and fortunately, I take the universalist side of my religious heritage seriously and don't believe in hell. So I don't think I have to worry about that one. I have actually been told, just happened again this past week, that being myself, just being who I am, is not only committing a sin, but I am encouraging others to go down that dark path as well. Pope Francis observed last year that transgender people are as dangerous as nuclear weapons. I thought he was supposed to be the good pope. Well, despite the way some people seem to spend a lot of time and energy on sin, whether their own or in the lives of those that they dislike, as Unitarian Universalists, we tend to not put too much effort into worrying about sin. But reacting to ideas about what sin is actually had a great deal to do with the founding of Unitarianism and Universalism, and still, I think, has an effect on our contemporary ethos, even though we might not be conscious of it. It's probably more obvious with the Universalists. 19th century Universalists had a penchant for arguing, mostly with their contemporaries who held different views, and sometimes with each other. I suppose we've inherited a little of that. Lots of those disagreements were published. If you read them, you quickly find common themes. Often, the more orthodox would challenge the universalists about the nature of sin. They would argue that people have a sinful nature and would easily give in to the temptation to violate God's law. Only the fear of eternal punishment in hell might begin to help restrain people from acting on their natural worst impulses. Well, the universalists would usually respond by saying that this view of God paints a picture of a very angry and uncaring creator, one who will not tolerate any defiance. But God, they believed, was loving, and that a caring God would not give up on any of us so easily. Instead, such a God would want the best for all of us, they argued, and that a God who is love was encouraging, trying to lead us forward rather than striking us down in retribution. When I've asked some Unitarian Universalists I know about the history of Universalism, if they know much of it at all, I find that they're usually taught that John Murray is considered the founder of the denomination. But the person who really deserves credit for popularizing the faith, for helping develop it into a real denomination and providing it with a theological foundation, was Hosea Ballou. I want to read part of a paragraph from what is probably his most famous and influential work. It is the Treatise on Atonement, written in 1805. As you might expect, he suggests that fear is a terrible motivator. Instead, he says, we should be looking for our own happiness. Now, please bear in mind as I read this, it was written 200 years ago. The objector will say, to admit that our happiness is the grand object of all, that we do destroy the purity of religion and reduce the whole to nothing but selfishness. In which I reply, a man acting for his own happiness, if he seek it in the heavenly system of universal benevolence, knowing that his own happiness is connected with the happiness of his fellow men, which induces him to do justly and to deal mercifully with all. He is no more selfish than he ought to be. But a man acting for his own happiness, if he seek it in the narrow circle of partiality and covetousness, his selfishness is irreligious and wicked. In other words, instead of doing what's right out of fear of God's wrath, we should be working for our own happiness. And our greatest happiness is found in working for the good of all, in seeking justice, in practicing mercy. Universalists, of course, only represent half of our tradition. Given the name Unitarian, it would be easy to assume, and most people do, that the origins of our faith were centered on denying the need for a Trinitarian conception of God. Now, for Unitarians in Europe, this is certainly true. But as with many things here in America, it's more complicated. There are some ways in which our own Unitarian forebears were as interested in the idea of sin long before they were concerned about a Trinity. By the way, when I started writing this part of my sermon, I seriously thought about calling it "An Irish Monk, a Dutch Minister, and a Unitarian Walk into a Bar." Now, you'll discover why that matters in just a moment, but fortunately, I chose not to call it that. To understand where the early American Unitarians were coming from, I first have to talk about original sin. The idea behind it, it goes something like this. Adam and Eve disobeyed God and ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. They became aware and became mortal. And all their descendants, i.e. us, inherited their sin. Jesus' death was a sacrifice to God to make up for this terrible sin. Even so, all humans are born with it and by implication are inherently sinful and need to be saved from their natural sinfulness. As complex as that is, at the time of the Reformation, John Calvin added to it. He provided a new wrinkle. He argued that not only are we inherently sinful, inherently bad, but the only way we can overcome our nature is through the grace of God. But we only get that if God already knows we're going to actually use it. So basically, it's all out of our hands. One of the first important objections to original sin, one of the first important objectors to original sin was an Irish monk named Pelagius. He lived toward the end of the 4th century. He preached, among other things, that Adam was always mortal, just like the rest of us, and didn't lose immortality through committing sin, and we're born not inherently bad, but in need of being saved. Now, Pelagius was controversial in his time, and after his death, his ideas were declared heretical. Now, let's flash forward about 1,200 years. There was this Dutch minister. His name was Jacobus Arminius. And he was born at the middle of the 16th century. Like Pelagius, he took issue with the doctrine of original sin, suggesting that humans were not naturally evil. He also reacted to Calvin's insistence that the cards are stacked against us. Arminius argued that we aren't just destined to be saved or condemned, that it's out of our hands, but rather we have a free will. We can choose what we do. We can disobey divine law, or we can do good. And in fact, it is our responsibility to make that choice. Now, some of Arminius's beliefs would go on to influence other religious movements like the early Methodists. He certainly had a big influence on the folks who would eventually become the first Unitarians in this country. The people behind the movement that would become Unitarianism started out in the Calvinist tradition. But like Arminius, they came to accept that we have a free will. We can choose. In fact, it's our responsibility to do so. These early New Englanders also came to believe, like Pelagius, that we are not born sinful. Rather, they firmly believed in the dignity of human nature. These New England Arminians led directly to the birth of Unitarianism. And their views, like Arminius and Pelagius, also led to a rejection of the Trinity. The logic of it goes something like this. If you believe that humans aren't born in sin, and all humanity does not require being saved by someone dying on a cross, then you open the door to questioning what Jesus was all about. And if you believed that humans possess free will and make their own choices, then you might start to think that we humans would be well suited with really good examples and role models to follow. These role models could point us in the direction of good choices. And for the early Unitarians, that's where Jesus fit in. He didn't need to be thought of as part of a complicated view of God, nor part of a scheme for saving all humanity by sacrificing. Rather, he could be seen as a fantastic role model. Conrad Wright was a professor at Harvard Divinity School, and he frankly was the leading historian of Unitarianism and congregational polity in the 20th century. I want to quote one sentence from him. The Arminians believed in the determination of character by environmental influences on a plastic original nature. In other words, it was believed that humans aren't inherently good and they aren't inherently bad and sinful. Rather, the kind of people we become is molded and shaped by many external forces. And for the early Unitarians, those shaping forces included role models and communities of people working for the good. I began this morning by suggesting that we don't talk much at all about sin. And to be honest, many of us really don't care. And for me, I'm fine with that. At the same time, I think it's worth revisiting sin, at least once in a while, because who we are as Unitarian Universalists and who we've become today is a direct result of our forebears responding to the idea of sin. Today, I believe we have a firm consensus on seeing the value of working for the good of all, of seeking justice, of practicing mercy in our lives. We don't think of humanity as lost and inherently bad, but I think we share in hope that all persons have worth and are deserving of dignity. In our own lives, we know we aren't preordained to take one particular path, but we can choose to do right. And the examples of our lives and the communities we're part of, while perhaps not perfect, can serve as guides for others, helping them find their way. Who we are today, who we have become is because those who came before us rejected the prevailing ideas of sin. And they have brought us to a very good place. Amen.